by, you know, Larry Elder says that he plans to use his veto power to cut funding to all of these programs that he opposes, including health care for our undocumented seniors, which has allowed them to stay alive. And many of the Latinos here, we have mixed status families, so this affects us all.
Jean, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Jean Guerrero is Los Angeles Times columnist. Her latest column, Gavin Newsom has been one of the most pro-Latino governors in California history, and he's under attack for it. She's author of Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. It's out in paperback this week. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Reds, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, and Andrea. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Je revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule.
KBOOK Music Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOOK in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The engineering committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, I'm Phil G. I'm one of the original hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends. We're on from noon to 2 on Saturdays. All August, we're bringing you very special episodes of Grateful Dead and Friends to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the show, and KBOO is raising money for a new studio transmitter link to bring sound to listeners. Tune in every Saturday from noon to 2 and text GDAF to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/grateful to contribute right now. We also have a special commemorative t-shirt that you can find on the kboo.fm website. Thank you for your support for Grateful Dead and Friends and KBOO Community Radio.
Listening to KBOO Portland. It is 8:02 and this is The Gap. Hello, hello. How's it going, Althea?
It's good to be here, Tammy. Thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to be in front of everybody this morning. How are you doing?
It's good, good. Just the usual unpleasantness of being on the roads during the early hours of the day. Just a reminder to people that an intersection isn't a place to switch lanes. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, that's just, you know, food for thought, and that's what we like to do here.
Yeah,
give you something to chew on. yeah, it's been a weird morning for me, if I may say so briefly. I only slept like an hour last night. I think it's because I dared to have a weird energy drink that my sister left in my car yesterday. And you know, in good news, I feel fine, and I finished a book. So. Sometimes those extra hours come in. But yeah, we have a great show for you this morning. So we always break our show into two chunks. And so in our first chunk, we have a great interview set up. We're going to be speaking with Mike Dewar, who is a Army veteran and now works for the State Department. And we're going to kind of be digging into, you know, what is missing in the current conversation about Afghanistan, the U.S.-NATO occupation, and the pullout that we're seeing right now.
That is right. And we do have Mike on the line with us. Mike, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me. Very, very happy to be here.
Fantastic. So like listeners might know, last week we were talking a bit about the plight of Afghan women. And of course, this story has been just developing pretty much every minute. And you, as a retired U.S. officer with over a decade of service and multiple deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq, we would, you know, love to hear about your experience working with the local populace, with leadership, NATO members, and just kind of get your take and perspective on what's happening there right now, as much as you can tell us from your experience.
Yeah, and so, you know, it is, you know, a very interesting thing of identifying that, you know, my experience is unique unto itself because of where I served and when, but also is also connected to a lot of the others. So I always kind of separate when it comes to when we talk about Afghanistan, we talk about people who have firsthand knowledge of Afghanistan, is like that kind of distinction between, I would really say, the soldiers and the aid workers that were on the ground working with the many local populaces there, and that experiences framed versus, you know, you can say the kind of the policy, academic, the higher level military, you know, decision makers and policy makers of what their experience was. And so, you know, my service in Afghanistan was back in 2011 into 2012. I was only there for a short period of time. Unfortunately, I was injured and I was medevaced out. But, you know, seeing everything kind of unfold over the last, you know, couple decades, 20 years, and also, you know, with that experience in Iraq as well, I was disheartened to see, I think, the last month, the conversations being had about Afghanistan when it comes to, I think, the op-eds, the pundits, the talking heads, the former special advisors or heads and generals of this or that, and kind of seeing the continuation of our misinterpretations, our mistakes, our misunderstandings about Afghanistan, about our actions in Afghanistan, not just at the military, not just at the government, not just at humanitarian aid, but all of it together, because all of it was connected. And so I've told plenty of my friends and colleagues that it's like, why do we keep listening to all these people? I'm sorry, I live near tracks, and there's a train going by, of course. But why do we continue to listen to all these advisors, all these experts, that they've been wrong for the last 20 years, and they kind of continue to be wrong now when they talk about what's happening in Afghanistan. So it is kind of disheartening. It is frustrating to kind of see this continuation of this, you know, broken narrative, broken misinterpretations of what we were doing there for the past 20 years.
Definitely. And what are some of the misconceptions that you think the American people have about the region and kind of some of the things that the media is getting wrong?
I think the first thing, and there's kind of three big takeaways or red flags I always see or look for when I read something or I hear someone talk, and this all kind of goes down to our kind of crutch and need for a narrative that we can kind of understand in a sense of black and white or right or wrong, good and bad. So the first thing is Afghanistan in itself. I think we still refer to and talk about Afghanistan in the concept of a nation state, of what we think of a country. And that's just inherently wrong. I've always kind of described Afghanistan as really as an ecosystem made up of 14 different ethnicities, dozens of different tribes, hundreds of clans in each of those tribes, and a continuation that can really go back centuries of fighting over land, water, other resources, and a sense of honor. And, you know, it's always easy to kind of fall into, and I've seen plenty of it, like, you know, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. And, you know, this is, you know, an extension of American imperialism or European colonialism, you know, a century before, which all have truths in it, which all has relevancy in it, but it doesn't necessarily accurately paint the entire picture, which is really a mosaic of what we refer to Afghanistan. That's kind of the first misconception or misperception. So when we have these discussions and you start referring to Afghanistan as some kind of country, you're already off to a wrong start. The second thing is when, you know, we talk about, well, now the former government of Afghanistan and also the Taliban, we think of them as institutions, as political institutions. And they're not. They're not, you know, the former government of, again, you know, Afghan government was not a government in the sense that we think of it in a Western lens, in a Western view of a democracy or even a technocratic a government. You know, it really was a patronage system of competing and aligned groups that came together out of a mutual agreement or mutual benefit that suited them, but then could change on a dime because it no longer suited them. And it was also influenced by as much as who was outside of that kind of coalition of partners versus inside. And the Taliban is the same way too. I hear constant conversations about the Taliban, Taliban this and Taliban that, is, you know, the Taliban's in charge, Taliban took over. Well, in all honesty, the Taliban is really more of a franchise. It's a brand versus a kind of monolithic entity, political force, fighting force that has one ideology, that is reaching towards one strategic goal. And I think that's also giving us a misperception when we see all the footage in the Kabul airport, in Kabul, talk about Afghan checkpoints, or we see Afghan leaders sitting in the president seat. You know, the Afghan... the Taliban is kind of really comprised of three separate and sometimes not always aligned entities. You know, the first, the political aspect of the Taliban, which is what you would see in the Doha, during the peace talks, the peace deal. And that is a Taliban that was of the 1996-2001 kind of government control. And once again, not in government like we think it is. The second entity is the fighting force of the Taliban. I think the very much more visual representation of Taliban that we see on the news every day. And that is even fractured within itself, because those entities, you know, that entity, you know, it's made up of 20-year-olds. I mean, people who weren't even alive when 9/11 happened, you know, or were kids when 9/11 happened and grew up in 20 years of U.S. and NATO occupation and were shaped by that. Also within that, you also have a lot of those Taliban fighters who grew up in refugee camps in Pakistan and who are children of refugees who, you know, were radicalized in those madrasas, given that support by the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence services, and then crossed the border to come back and to fight in Afghanistan. And they had their conflicts and you know, cultural differences, really, to the local populace that had always been in Afghanistan. And then you also have the regional Taliban groups. So the Kandahar kind of Taliban, which is supported primarily by the Pakistani ISI. You also then have the Hamadi kind of Taliban, and they're really, to be honest, more narco-terrorists. They control the opium fields, or the majority of the opium crops in Afghanistan, and they're labeled Taliban, but they're all competing interests. I mean, kind of the Taliban spokesman, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you know, talked about that they're going to enforce, you know, banning drugs and stuff. Well, that doesn't necessarily align with the Hamadi Taliban that controls the opium. So even right now, you see that the Taliban has even built a coalition or announced a government because they're trying to figure that all out too. The third kind of misperception is, and I don't know if it's too much of a misperception, to be honest, but it's more of just my kind of thought process and my concerns with all of it all, is no one's going to be fired over the bad policies of Afghanistan. no general, no special advisor, no ambassador, no UN head of a mission. None of them were going to be really held accountable and said, you did a bad job, you made bad decisions, you didn't know what you were doing, or we didn't get the right information, and we made bad decisions based off that, and now you're fired. And accountability is only going to be had at op-eds and tweets versus anything kind of real fundamental shifts. And I think that's a shame, because people's lives are at stake, and people lost their lives over this, and lives are now affected greatly. We see it in the news. But, you know, where the accountability will be. I think there'll be a lot of, hand-wringing about it, but it'll soon kind of pass. But I think, you know, for our discussion here and for everyone out there listening, you know, this isn't just an idea of right or wrong or bad or good or injustice or justice. This is it always was a complicated thing. And to not kind of always have that be at our forefront, always have that be part of our discussion, ultimately then we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes. We're doomed to think that this was a standalone event and failure, or place it unnecessarily on people that we feel is a good scapegoat to it. And so I think that's something that we should always be considering when we're looking at as this all unfolds, because it's still being, it's still happening, of really what this all means.
Yeah, and thank you for kind of breaking that down for us, Mike. Can you tell us a little bit about what your experience was being deployed in Afghanistan? I know you did some mediation and conflict resolution work. What did that look like?
Yeah, so, oddly enough, I joined the Army kind of pre-9/11, and I was, when I commissioned, became an officer back in 2005, I was trained in tanks. I was an armor officer, and so, my training and everything was is commanding tanks, commanding an armor platoon. Well, what I found myself when I was in Iraq and in Afghanistan was really being that mediator, was really being that conflict resolution, and trying to resolve conflicts that were complex and centuries deep, and me being part of a problem. In Afghanistan, I was part of a counterinsurgency training team that was run in Kabul by the British and the Canadians. I was part of this international coalition of force that was training NATO officers, Afghanistan Army officers, in kind of counterinsurgency operations. And I was able to then travel about Kunar province, working with the provincial reconstruction team and U.S. forces in the area. And really, what I came down to, I was like the arbiter. I was the mediator, working with a lot of the local tribes, working with the local populace, working with the local security forces, and resolving conflicts. And it wasn't, fighting the Taliban. It was fighting police corruption. It was resolving inter-tribal, inter-clan, inter-family disputes, because we were viewed, and even as much as we were viewed as a foreign occupier or an example of American imperialism, we were a power in the region, and we have benefit, and we could provide resources and money and everything to allow these people to resolve their differences and disputes. And that got me really interested into that, because I received really no training. I mean, that's not what you think of the military should be doing or would be doing. And so that kind of led me down that path. And so I really kind of pursued that, and which ultimately led me, here to State Department, but also as a mediator and an instructor as well.
That's really fascinating, and to do that on the capacity that that you were describing must have been pretty interesting. And it kind of makes me think a bit about a possible shift in either priorities or policy when it comes to foreign policy, but also just more specifically to Afghanistan. So you just beforehand mentioned that this possibly could be looked at as a standalone, and so my question to you is this a standalone, perhaps failure, or is this, is Afghanistan and the pullout more of a catalyst for like a greater shift in foreign policy?
To the main theme of this is there's no right or wrong, right? I think it means a lot of things, and sometimes they're kind of opposite to each other. So one is, I think, and this is kind of already kind of happening, is the idea of like nation building, especially within the military, U.S. and NATO, is we're not nation builders, right? We shouldn't be. And there's a role that a military force plays in that, but we're not nation builders, boots on the ground sort of way. As much as a standalone international aid group is a nation builder, I think we've learned now that nation building by PowerPoint isn't the answer, meaning, I just need to build so many schools. I just need to raise the literacy rate so high. I just need to have free and fair elections. I just need to have, a base of educated individuals with a desire to serve to be those public servants. Clearly, that hasn't worked in Iraq. Clearly, that hasn't worked in Afghanistan. And we were never really doing that in the first place, I think, through all our misadventures during the Cold War. And that goes to international aid groups as well. And so the first thing is counterinsurgency. Operating in asymmetrical warfare, low-intensity conflicts. After our pullout in Iraq in 2012 and now with our departure in Afghanistan, the U.S. military, and I'll loop in NATO as well, is that we just don't like doing those type of things. We came up with a training manual, field manual for counterinsurgency, but that's not really utilized or practiced anymore. We did the shift to east, to near peer competition with Russia and China, and going back to a conventional fighting sense. I think rightfully so, after Iraq, I think we did come to some conclusions that like we're just not good at it, and that's not what we should be doing as a fighting force, as a military. I think the impact from also all of that is, and I'm waiting to see it happen, because I don't think it has happened, is that the international aid community, as well as policymakers, haven't grappled with those failures, with those struggles, as much as I think, and people may call me biased, but as the military has. International aid groups, I think, still operate on the pretense that, well, I'm neutral and biased, so therefore I'm neutral and unbiased. And my aid projects of building a well or building a girls' school doesn't contribute, doesn't have second, third order effects when it comes to a conflict between two parties. And Afghanistan is an example where it did have an impact. I don't know if those conversations have been had, and a kind of realization or adjustments of how you would operate in those kind of things has been had. And it clearly hasn't really happened at the policymaker level beyond just we're not going to do that anymore, and we'll find our political rival to blame. As much as, you see Biden being blamed with a lot of this, Biden inherited after four presidents or four presidential administrations and a horrible thrown together peace deal that the Trump administration put together. Sure, he made faults, sir. He maybe not be doing something what we all wanted to be doing, but it's not solely his fault to what everything happened. But to more your point there, Tammy, about changing U.S. policy, foreign policy, I don't think so too much. That's why I say it's more of a standalone. I think our European Union allies are our Middle East Arab and allies in Israel are all concerned with a U.S. pullout, a U.S. withdrawal, but they know where the interests lie. They know that we can't do a complete thing, but it does take, I think, also a little bit of realization. I have to say, and it's not just the Trump administration rhetoric, but it was happened before about, NATO and the EU, committing more of the costs and expense to maintaining NATO and building a military force. There's some truth there. I found it a little bit hypocritical of the G7 criticizing and trying to persuade President Biden to extend the deadline of U.S. troops there and to remain. look, the U.S. submitted 5,000 soldiers, 13 sailors, 13 Marines, a sailor, and two soldiers were killed in that suicide bombing yesterday, which is tragic. But there's 5,000 compared to 500 British, compared to dozens Norwegian. You know, if the European Union, if NATO wanted to extend, they could extend and send more troops there. And we could have the United States have a smaller presence. There's nothing stopping them from doing that. What's stopping from doing that is they don't necessarily have the resources or the manpower to commit or be able to commit such a large amount of force as quickly as well as that we can, right or wrong, for the U.S. capabilities. But that's a kind of a separate point.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, to your mind, how would a more nuanced understanding of the ecosystem of Afghanistan, as you put it, how would that, you know, have changed U.S. involvement or even the approach to peace talks and trying to pull out?
Well, you know, I think one is just acknowledging the cultural differences and understanding the limitations that you're never really going to fully understand. You know, we have a lot of Afghan experts who call themselves Afghan experts that do have a lot of expertise, but they're not 100% accurate, right? They're not encompassing of everything. And their advice may only get you so far as when it comes to being successful. I think also it comes down to is the people that live in the area that we call Afghanistan just want to be left alone. And didn't want a democracy. They didn't necessarily want, I mean, I worked with villagers that didn't want electricity or didn't even want a road. They just wanted to be left alone to live their lives the way they've been living their lives for probably hundreds of years. And, you know, it's been kind of, you know, making sure that region is aligned to what we need it to be, to one, you know, Soviet Union and the Soviet sphere back in the Cold War, to the British not wanting Afghan tribesmen to be raiding south into, you know, into the British Raj, and engaging, a buffer state between, you know, a Russia that wanted to be more influential in the region. That had all nothing to do with Afghanistan or people living in that region. It just happened to do with the greater geopolitical, goings on. And for the 20 years in Afghanistan, we didn't even resolve or address any of the regional issues there, which is kind of, once again, mind-boggling that you spent 20 years trying to stabilize this country, but you didn't even address any of the regional issues that goes across borders there. And so I think that's my lesson learned. That's the thing we talk about is, what are you trying to accomplish there? What does that really look like? And then, does that mean you need to do X, Y, and Z for the next 20 years to accomplish that? And I don't think we ever really truly asked ourselves that. And I don't think we even are right now.
You said folks pretty much just kind of want to be left alone. And earlier you mentioned that the region is more of an ecosystem. So in the pictures and videos that we're seeing, it seems, you know, Kabul is more of an urban area. Can you talk a little bit about the role urban divide in the region and how that ties into how we saw so many security forces kind of stepping down or just kind of like making space for the next, you know, whatever forceful, occupants are coming in?
Yeah. And so, you know, the big misperceptions I talked about earlier all feed into this. So, you know, Afghanistan is primarily, you know, rural. It's like 70-75% rural. And the rest is kind of a small minority of urban. So Afghanistan's really kind of like a bowl. The region's kind of bowl-shaped. So you have in the center of the lowlands a lot of the agricultural land, and it's kind of dominated by the three major urban centers. So Kabul, Kandahar, Bagram, they're kind of in the kind of center of the bowl, and it's surrounded by the hill mountains of the rural region. So, and this is what's complex about it, and this is what's really kind of tough when you fight against the narrative. Look, what's happening in Kabul, what's happening at the airport is tragic. It is something that we do need to be addressing in a wholehearted way when it comes to getting out people whose lives are in danger for one working with and believing in U.S. and NATO, in the West, in the idea of democracy, that they could build an Afghanistan. And they're trying to get out now because their lives are in danger. But that is, to be honest, a small minority of the people who live in this area called Afghanistan. Even within Kabul, you know, everyone else are this is their life. This is almost normality. And also probably in the long run, the rapid collapse of the former Afghan government and now kind of the takeover by these Taliban factions, probably in this quick fashion, probably saved a lot of lives. I mean, we all talk about, you know, you mentioned the Afghan army surrendering. You know, the Afghan army didn't really surrender to an extent. Now, there was real issues with the Afghan army. A lot of my fellow veterans will have a lot of tales, and you can listen to a lot of them, of just how inept they were. But they didn't just throw down their arms and surrender. I mean, they essentially switched sides. They were all part of a tribe. They're all part of a clan. And they were nominally loyal or recognizing themselves as the Afghan army, as an Afghan citizen, supporting the Afghan government, supporting the Afghan people, because there was Western money supporting them and they're benefiting from it. And so when that dried up, when that stopped, it no longer was the benefit to maintain this coalition, this charade of a government, the charade of an army, and they just switched sides. They switched sides to the Taliban, they switched sides to their own independent kind of warlords, and they looked after their homeland, which they always viewed outside of the idea of Afghanistan. To the rural and urban divide in this, all this feeds into the fact that then you have these groups. You have, you know, Kabul is a population of about 3 million, and you have, you know, roughly, I think people estimate it's around 250,000, 300,000 Afghan citizens, dual citizens trying to get out of the country right now. So that's only a small percentage of even the population of Kabul. And so, once again, I'm not trying to downplay the plight of these people. That's the farthest thing. But what I'm trying to give is here the context that this isn't Afghanistan. This isn't that's happening across the country. This isn't made up of everyone from the area. It's happening to a very hyper-focused minority that were able to, one, I think, benefit greatly from the last 20 years, and meaning not just corruption of power and money, but like education, of getting access to the greater world, of understanding and wanting the idea of an actual nation state of Afghanistan, which is what the tragic piece is, that we had people here who truly believed in American exceptionalism, right? Democracy, you know, human rights, women's rights, that now they're being left in the lurch. And the other tragedy, and this is why the narrative kind of gets in the way, is, you know, we really hyper-focus on the Taliban and the Taliban's despicable, horrible treatment of women, and thinking that it wasn't like that for the last 20 years, and now it's going to come back in full force. Sadly and tragically, that's not the case. It has always been like that for Afghan women, especially for Afghan women in the rural areas that don't have the connection to any of this, you know, greater access of resources and education. And so life for them didn't change, and life for them is not going to change. That's still tragic and horrible. But to think the narrative is only now Afghan women are going to be suffering is kind of a false narrative. And the Taliban being at the hands of it isn't, you know, being the perpetrators isn't the only perpetrators. I mean, I don't think they would be able to have had the influence control that they do if there wasn't already underlining kind of horribleness of patriarchy that built the foundation that they just grew off of. And so I think that can help put perspective, though, the people who are outside those gates right now, the airport, trying to get out, and who they are and why we need to speed up the process to get them out, and not fall into the, once again, the Islamophobic, xenophobic rhetoric that people will spew about letting these refugees into the country, because these are the people who you know are the exemplary examples of what we always try to be ourselves, which mm-hmm. you know, we can always talk about how we fall short.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, all of that just makes me think about how, you know, even the conception of a nation state is like a 200-year-old idea. It's a 200, 300 years old. It's not necessarily one size fits all. Mike, mm-hmm. we're coming up on the end of our time here. I want to give you the opportunity. Is there like one takeaway that you think is, you know, worth stressing again, if our listeners to like take one thing home to take away from this conversation?
Yeah, you know, I think another thing too, and this is also, I think, a lot of the kind of the social media, you know, kind of out there, is, you know, not to forget that the Afghan, you know, the Afghan people, and when I talk about Afghan people, the 14 different ethnicities, the dozens of tribes, the hundreds of clans in those tribes, they have their agency, right? They are not just victims to American imperialism, to Western colonialism. They also, you know, were able to, you know, to be honest, to manipulate us for their own benefit and gain. You know, a wonderful saying that the Taliban always has is, you know, you may own all the watches, but we own the time. You know, you may come in here with all your technology, with all your ideals, with all your, you know, thoughts and knowledge, but at the end of the day, this is our land, and we're always going to be here, and we're always going to remain. And you can't change that. And I think that's also something that we need to acknowledge as well, is that this isn't just, we destroyed Afghanistan, we destroyed these people. I'm not downplaying the tragedy that's playing unfolding, but at the end of the day too, as well, is that for a lot of Afghans right now, they're just going to be able to live their lives in more relatively peace, hopefully. But unfortunately, there's probably going to be more and more fighting, and that's also part of the culture, part of the long history of these people as well, as just constant fighting. In Pashto, it's Baladan, which is vengeance. It's a continuing cycle of abuse that they always go through, and not to immediately think that they're victims. But this is the lives that they live to it as well. So I think that's also something that we need to acknowledge, and also help color and understand the complexity to all this as well.
Yeah, gotta get all those shades of gray in there. Well, Mike, exactly. We really, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, this has been absolutely great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I hope you have a great rest of your day. That was Mike Duer. He is an Army veteran who now works for the State Department. We've been talking about what has been missing in understanding the conflict, occupation, and pullout of Afghanistan. You are listening to The Gap on KBOO Portland. We're going to head into a quick midway song, and then we'll be back with the second half of our show, where we get to talk to you with our community questions. So stick around, stay with us. You're listening to The Gap.
Listening to KBOO Portland. This is The Gap. I'm Tammy, and in studio with me is one and only Althea Billings. How are you, Althea?
I'm doing all right. Very, very happy about that interview that we just had, and I'm stoked to get into the second half here with our community question. So today we want to talk to you about the so-called Great Resignation. I feel like great something or other has the same energy as like sticking gate at the end of like a scandal.
Ooh, like Pizzagate, Watergate. Pizzagate,
yeah. Watergate just gets tacked onto everything. It's just the name of a hotel. So it sounds like a really big deal, but, you know, essentially it's There's been some studies, like 4 million people quit their jobs in April. And there's been some studies recently to show that especially younger workers are facing like serious job dissatisfaction out of the pandemic, and that is influencing their thoughts going forward. And so our question for you is, how has your perception of work or work-life balance changed since the pandemic began? Do you see yourself approaching the job market differently going forward? Give us a call, 503-231-8187. We would love to hear your perspective. And to give you a little bit more background, we do have a quick clip right now.
All right, the Great Resignation. That's what some experts are calling the growing trend of workers quitting or just changing careers. The pandemic driving a shift in work culture and what's expected at the office and beyond. In a recent study, 65% of employees say they're looking for a new job, and 88% of executives say they're seeing a higher turnover than normal.
In the month of May alone, 3.6 million Americans quit their jobs. And that's down from the month before, with almost 4 million walking out the door in April. A two-decade high, by the way. It's what's being called the Great Resignation. The mass exodus comes as many companies are trying to get employees back into the office by the fall. So why are so many people leaving?
With the pandemic, I was kind of just like, it was a lot of reflection time. I know what I want out of my career. Might as well just make the move.
Some say they feel burned out after working through a year that had so many challenges.
People's mental health are so bad right now. Like, people are prioritizing that a lot more than like their jobs or anything else.
Most people are less than thrilled about returning to the office, with 89% of workers saying they'd prefer to work remotely at least some of the time. One in three employees are considering leaving their job, according to personal finance website Magnify Money. And popular job search site Indeed estimates that as many as 9.8 million jobs are available in the U.S. as of mid-July. That's 1 million more openings than there are people looking for work.
Well, the good things for job seekers is that they are not only successful in interviewing, but also getting job offers and multiple offers. So that means that companies are competing for top talent. So it's a good time to be looking for a job.
That was a little news clip explaining what the Great Resignation is, with some info from NBC and CNBC there. But yeah, that there have been people making job shifts, changing their ideas about what work is, what work-life balance is, and particularly young people. Some of the studies that have been, you know, kind of cited in this. I don't know, situation that's going on. Great Resignation makes it sound so dramatic. Like,
sounds like something like, who would write? Like, what the Great Gatsby.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, there you go.
Cheryl, that's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah, it's got some drama to it. But, you know, that people are thinking about, you know, having more flexible work schedules, having better benefits, being able to, you know, get a wage that supports a lifestyle outside of just working all the time. So we'd love to get your thoughts on this. How has your perception or approach to work and work-life balance changed since the pandemic began? Give us a call, 503-231-8187.
I feel like there's just always going to be a lot of, I think that this the millennials and the generations that follow, we just get a lot of people have a lot of issue. They say, oh, you people and your avocado toast. Oh, you people, you're driving down the diamond market. And it's just like, I think our things that we find interesting or important are shifting drastically. And it's not that it comes out of nowhere. Like, all of these things, they have, it's like a cause, you know, like things, there's a cause and effect, and it's just a reaction to you know, to the presence and to what's happened, to reality pretty much. And to, you know, the wages are pretty stagnant. And mm-hmm. while maybe 20 years ago, even, you know, 30 years ago, 15 years ago, even, you'd be able to, you know, your dollar went longer. Mm-hmm. But now it's really not the case. And, you know, things are a lot more expensive. And I mean, you know, like, another thing that comes to mind is this whole fight that we had for $15 an hour. I remember that fight being around in 2010, you know, like 2012. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wait, now we're getting $15. what's up? That's, you know, so I think I'm really loving that this is the great exodus, as they called it. Like, could they use any more dramatic words?
Yeah.
But yeah, we'd love to hear people's points of views about this, especially, you know, like post-pandemic, where it just, I think a lot of us had to reassess a lot of things. 503-231-8187 is the number. Yes, Althea.
Yeah, I was going to say, or sort of mid-pandemic, as the cases tend to rise again. But yeah, it's very interesting that, you know, that it's pushed more people to think about this at like a broader scale rather than just like the individual level. Can we do the TikTok watch? I have a TikTok to show everybody. It is from the Washington Post.
This is TikTok Watch with the Gap hosts, Althea Billing and Tammy Haptias.
So according to this Washington Post poll, the two most important things to teens are being successful in a career and having enough free time to do the things that you want to do. Yeah, how can you have a successful career and have free time?
Having free time can be good for your mental health, and then having strong mental health can be good for your career.
Hold on, slow down. So you can be happy and successful?
Yeah, you're getting it.
What else do you know?
What time of day were you born?
All right, that's enough.
Classic Aquarius.
just a little TikTok taste for you. Gotta revive our old segments every now and again. That was from the Washington Post. They got a pretty funny TikTok guy. But yeah, just the outrage of like, wait, you can be happy and successful?
And I think there's a lot of factors to it. I think I think this is great for the show because there is like that, it's not like a generational gap, it's more of like a technology gap, I think, where, you know, when you go into the workspace after college or, you know, university or high school or just, you know, whenever it is that you have to, because, you know, you got to get paid, pay the bills, you aren't just working with people your age. You know, there's people from all walks of life. And when it comes to technology, again, like 10 years ago even, we did not have the same technology that we have now. So there's that gap. And I think that creates, well, first, I think that younger people tend to get pigeonholed as the IT person at a, you know, at like their place of work because of like this exact kind of divide. I think there's also the fact that we have phones and emails on our phones and Slack and WhatsApp and like all of these things. It's just like so many different ways of getting in touch. And if you aren't online, what are you doing? You know?
Right.
And I think having all of that and then stepping into the pandemic when it first began was just like that concept of mental health. It I think really came to the forefront. I know I wasn't doing well, you know? But yes, we'd love to hear your take on it. 503-231-8187 is the number.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you so much more. I mean, this is something that I've kind of like thought for some time, thinking about like the pandemic. At the very least, you had, you know, most people had, you know, somewhere around 2 weeks where there was like, you know, things grinding to a halt. And that's not necessarily true for all essential workers. But because there was such a massive shift in the way that, you know, everybody operates, it does kind of like pose reflection for it. And, you know, people want to do things that are meaningful on and off the clock. And that, you know, taking a moment to reassess a lot of the studies that are being done around this are seeing that, you know, people are this is the time they want to make a career shift. This is the time that they want to leave their job because there are so many opportunities out there right now, and find one that works better for them, has more flexibility, has better benefits, can offer them more advancement, which, you know, those, especially like, you know, benefits and advancement, like those aren't necessarily like central in the zeitgeist of like what is a good job. You know, it's like, oh, does it pay well? Does it pay well? Are the hours okay? But that there's a broader kind of scope to that career development. Yeah.
And there is, I'm looking at this USANews.com article, and they are kind of talking about the survey, this Adobe survey that was done, and there is 72% of companies surveyed are either going to raise or have raised their salaries. So, you know, there's things are happening.
Yeah, yeah. And, part of that Adobe study was kind of what you were talking about, Tammy, that, administrative type tasks, if that is the kind of field that you're in, are a big thing that, like, creates employee burnout. You know, not working efficiently. So many things, you know, kind of like stuck in their ways, which obviously the pandemic exposed a lot of those things. Cough, the Oregon Employment Department, cough.
And we do have our first caller on the line. Jones, are you there?
Hi there. Yes, yes, yes. Older person's point of view is it's about time. It's really about time. People have been wage slaves for much too long and finally realizing that this is an American issue. I had a friend in the 1990s, early 90s, who was from Italy, and she said, "You Americans are just crazy when it comes to work." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "You would go to work on your own grandmother's birthday." And she was appalled by the notion that it would be somebody's grandmother's birthday and that they would rather go to work.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
There's something really weird about our culture. It's money driven. It's all about the money. And there's a reason why there's so many people being allowed to live on the streets and why the rents are so high. And while everybody is on a hamster wheel, and if you're not on the hamster wheel, you could wind up on the street.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think people are finally coming to the point where, hey, there's something wrong with this. And the labor union movement is picking up and cooperatives are picking up. And yes, things are shifting. And yes, nobody wants to be a $7 an hour wage slave anymore, and a college education is supposed to somehow get you out of that, but for the past few years, it has not gotten you out of it. How many college-educated people, whatever that means, are working in these low-wage jobs? And even a truck driver or a construction worker or somebody who's doing really high-skilled work, a lot of those people are still making relatively low wages considering what their work is doing to their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the lack of respect that people get for doing important things like getting rid of the garbage and looking at the climate. So I say it's about time and the system is turning over and good. I just hope that we can make something good out of it that includes everybody, because there have been too many people who've been left out. And we have to look at the education system, too. What are we channeling kids into, right?
Yeah.
What kind of kids are going into what, and do they have a choice in the matter? So I say, good, let's think about it. And what's a career? Is there anything wrong with working with your hands, if that's what you like to do?
Right, yeah, changing
is
that kind of
Is it all about these robots and things? What kind of science fiction fantasy is that? And where does that come from, and who's making money off of it?
Right.
Followed money.
Yeah, thank
and
you so much. Yeah, thank
You're
you
welcome.
So much for that, you know, that perspective there. I think that is a really important thing to point out, and you know, noticing that the economy depends on workers. It's like it's the workers that generate profits, not businesses themselves.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos just told us that before he went to space. He's like, "This is all you. This is all you. You did this."
Tammy and I were joking about that yesterday. Tammy was like, He did know the mic was on when he said that Amazon employees sent him to space, right?
But Joan did bring up a good point. I think you were also speaking about it yesterday when we were talking about Nabisco and just the momentum of the strike, and which started here. So
yeah,
shout out to Portland.
Shout out the Nabisco workers.
So yeah, if you want to talk about that.
Just that Nabisco workers have been on strike, started in Portland, is now a nationwide strike for the past couple weeks. And because they've worked through the entire pandemic and their parent company is now trying to reorganize their schedules so that they essentially can't take overtime. So, you know, working more than, I mean, for them, it hasn't been 8-hour days, 40-hour weeks, you know. But not being able to pay overtime, which should be time and a half, and cutting benefits and outsourcing their factory production to Mexico, even though they, you know, Nabisco, which makes various cookies and crackers, has seen record profits this year, and yet they're still trying to squeeze the workers.
And it's like we know all this, like the information about profit margins and all that, like it's all accessible and available for people to see. Plus, a lot of these people, like Jeff Bezos, just go on TV or YouTube or whatever and say, oh, while you peons are struggling during a pandemic, I'm going to go to space. And you know what? This was all you. So it's like, I definitely heard some pundits say that this generation is lazy. And if you didn't eat so much avocado toast and buy cappuccinos, maybe you'll be able to buy a home with diamonds on it.
Yeah. But
I just...
The dream,
right? Yeah. I think that there's just so many... I don't know if it's because of information, if it's... You know, each generation has their own thing. Mm-hmm. And I definitely am seeing, like, a shift in what people's priorities are and how they want to live their lives. And more importantly, what they want out of life. Mm-hmm. And maybe... And I don't think it's, like, shade or disrespectful or anything to generations beforehand. If anything, it's seeing how hard they've worked. And it's, like... hearing, you know, living with them, whether they're parents, grandparents, you know, uncle, whatever family, and you realize like that there's got to be more to life than working for, you know, for wage slavery. And what, and if you don't, well, it's eat or die. That's
right.
And that's, those aren't options, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that, you know, would love to refer folks to some graphs here, because the evidence is out there that, you know, as Tammy was talking about earlier, minimum wage was meant to be the floor, and that it was much easier for people to, you know, with a high school degree, get a job that they could stay in that could sustain them and their family in, you know, a middle class lifestyle. And that has not grown as the years have gone on. The wages have stagnated. So I think the kind of great resignation is a really, I mean, like we said, dramatic title for it, but it's really interesting to see it and to see, especially, I mean, there's certain sectors of employment that are being hit harder than others. We've talked about on the show before, like exodus from healthcare jobs. Mm-hmm. There's like education jobs people are leaving, and definitely like service sector, you know, people facing where there's, you know, a lot more concern about coronavirus, and the way that your job is handled is very much like controlled by, you know, the whims of your county government. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, people are like reassessing, and especially, you know, thinking about what are the costs and the benefits of your job. You know, what do you really get out of it? Are you being paid enough for the cost that you endure? And I think it's a good time for people to think about that. I have a friend who just recently like got a job, and she's like within a few weeks taken on the work of like other people, other assistants, and is taking work home and not citing it as comp time for fear that, you know, her employer will be upset about that. But what that is you're working overtime for no pay. You're taking work from other people and taking it home. Like, you know, if what your employer should do in that situation is say like, hey, you know, it doesn't work for me to be giving you like 20 to 40 overtime hours a week. I can't, or not overtime, but comp time or whatever. I can't have you accruing that much. So how do we make things more efficient? Don't take on other people's work. I think it's something like, you know, boundary setting is a tough thing to do.
Yes, especially after being in, you know, like Joan said, what is school like? And in school, it's very, like, you know, you're saying collaborative, very much everyone, you know, group projects,
yeah,
everyone gets graded
out
together. Yeah, if you see someone struggling, help them out. And the world is just really not like that. The workforce, definitely not, unfortunately.
I remember getting, like, when I got my first job, you know, having the only other, like, intensive work I had done, having been, like, high school. It was like so jarring and liberating to like get to leave after 8 hours and like not have more stuff to do.
Right.
And that, you know, that's the design of the 8 hour, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, or the 8 hour work day is so that you have 8 hours of work, 8 hours of sleep, and 8 hours to do whatever you want.
Yeah. People marched on it not too far from here, actually. Yeah. That's it, you know. So people, the chickens are coming home to roost, I guess. You know, and the great escape of of the resignation.
The chicken run of the workers.
The chicken run.
They've been
the
let
greatest,
out of the coop.
Of the Great Escape. That's,
and now they're free range.
Now we're free range, just ruining the diamond industry and eating our avocado toast.
The metaphor got away from me.
Yeah,
but that's okay.
This is interesting, and again, I think this is all because, you know, kind of like being on the shoulders of giants, you know, and because we had the people that marched in Seattle for the 8-hour workday, and because we had, you know, the hippies that decided to shake things up, and because we have people right now that are, you know, kind of trying to just, you know, move the needle in a different direction, and it's the most powerful when we as a collective power all together do it. And what, yeah, I mean, they're just making so much money. Record you know, sales this year, or I guess last year and this year too. And we're seeing things like Robin Hood, you know, like the Robin Hood. We had an episode on the webpage, kbo.fm/thegap. You can see people are just, they're starting to wise up, and, you know, and why not? More power to us.
Yeah, there's a lot of instances to see that, I'm just thinking the power is concentrated with the people. The people need to know how to wield the power, and their right to wield it needs to be protected. But, you know, we are not solely at the mercy of mega corporations,
never,
you know?
Never that.
And something that has, I think it was said last week on the show that I've been thinking about all week, systemic problems require systemic solutions. You know, apply that to anything, but it definitely relates to, you know, people being dissatisfied with their working conditions. Maybe it's not them individually that are the problem, especially when you're seeing it in these mass numbers. Maybe instead it's the system's problem that, you know, it's a capitalist system that chews people up and spits them out, you know?
Yep. It's like Joan said, wage slavery. And we are just about out of time for our show today. Thank you all so much for tuning in. You can go to kbo.fm to see what we talked about today. Thank you so much, Mike Duer, for the interview. And we are out. Have a fantastic weekend.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
This is Sun Lee. I'm the host of the Grateful Dead and Friends show every second Saturday of the month from noon to 2 p.m.